That's when you decided to shoot twice?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's called a double tap, right?
Yes, sir.
Is that what you were intending?
Yes, sir.
That's your training, isn't it?
It's what we're trained to do.
It's training. Double tap maximizes the lethality of your shooting, doesn't it?
Yes, sir. Just did what I was trained to do.
Hi everyone, I'm Kevin and welcome to Just Thought Lounge. We're going to examine a case this week that made headlines across the United States in 2019. It is as unusual as it is heartbreaking. The story begins with what appears on its face to be a horrible mistake, a collection of bad circumstances that culminated in the death of an exceptional person who was only starting out in life. But as the facts and all considerations emerged at trial, that tragic accident took on a different interpretation, one in which a split-second decision, one to shoot to kill, changed everything. Let's take a look. At just past 10 p.m. on September 6, 2018, a Thursday night, Officer Amber Geiger of the Dallas Police Department was returning home after completing her shift. She pulled into a parking space at the Southside Flats apartment complex where she had lived for just under 2 months. Amber reversed her white pickup truck into the space at her building. This was a habit she had developed through her police training, one of many. It meant that she could, if and when needed, drive out quickly and easily. Amber was a 5-year veteran of the police department. On that Thursday night, she was returning from over 13 hours on duty, one of a string of longer days that she had worked that week, clocking up overtime for every hour that she stayed past 4 p.m. On her way to her apartment door, Amber was burdened with a pile of police equipment and various bags. She had just left work and the police station was just around the corner, so she remained in uniform but carried in all of her accessories. These she handled all on her left-hand side, which was yet another habit developed from police training. She kept her strong side free for swift access to her holsters in case she needed to access her weapon and quickly. Down 2 corridors and to the front door of her unit, she held out the key fob to access her apartment. She noticed first that the door was a little ajar. She also thought that she could hear a shuffling noise from inside. Simply holding her key fob towards the electric lock applied enough pressure to swing the door open. No one left alive save Amber knows exactly what happened next. Did the person in the apartment call out to her? Did that person rush or move towards her? What is not in dispute is that the next action Amber took was to fire her weapon twice. Moments later, Amber turned on the lights. She looked around. She doesn't recognize the couch. Then she doesn't recognize the TV set. And then everything else is unknown to her except the layout of the unit itself. She is in the wrong apartment, standing exactly one floor above her own home. And there's a man that she also does not know laying at her feet. Amber called 911.
Dallas 911, this is Carla. What's your emergency?
Hi, this is an off-duty officer. Can I get, I need emails. I'm in number.
Do you need police as well or just EMS?
Yes, I need both.
Okay, what's the address?
I'm at apartment number 1478. I'm in 1470. I'm an off-duty officer. I thought it was in my apartment, and I shot a guy thinking that he was thinking it was my apartment.
He shot someone?
Yes, I thought it was my apartment. I'm Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
Okay, and where are you at right now?
I'm in, what do you mean? I'm inside the apartment with him. Hey, come on.
What's your name?
I'm Amber Geiger. I need to get me,
Okay, we have help on the way.
I know, but I'm going to lose my job. I thought it was my apartment.
Okay, and you're fine. Hold on.
Hey, bud. Come on. I thought it was my apartment.
I understand. We have help on the way.
The full 911 recording is over 5 minutes long. After the initial minute and a half, however, the pattern of the call is consistent. Amber states 20 times in the course of that 5 minutes that she thought she was entering her own apartment. She states twice that she is very tired. She apologizes to the man that she has shot. She also exclaims more than once that the incident will almost certainly mean that she will lose her job. Considering the proximity from the Southside Flats apartment complex and the police station where Amber works, the time from dispatch to arrival at the address is only 2 minutes. The police respond to the building and approach with guns drawn. During this time, it's not clear that Amber had attempted any CPR or attempted to stem the bleeding. She is outside the door of the apartment when the officers reach the fourth floor. In the body cam footage of Officer Michael Lee, Amber is seen guiding the police into the correct apartment on camera only briefly. She is heard explaining that she is off duty, that she called in the shooting, and again, that she believed the apartment was hers. Frantic and pacing on the balcony outside of the apartments, Amber stayed present at the scene but mostly out of the way. While EMTs rush out with the man she has shot in his home, she found a seat inside a police cruiser. She places her head down, away from the emergency efforts underway, and appears to be texting. As she does this, medical personnel rush past. A sergeant then leans in and instructs another officer to turn off the dash camera in the cruiser. He says he gave this instruction so that Amber could call her lawyer. ''26-year-old Botham John finished his work that day at the Big Four accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers, or just PwC, and was watching Thursday night NBA basketball. Bo loved sports, but his biggest passion was singing. Born in St. Lucia to parents Allison and Bertham, he was a middle child. With a sister 10 years older and baby brother 10 years younger, his mother said he was the glue of the family linking everyone together. The stories told of Botham are of a man that was compassionate, thoughtful, and accomplished. In St. Lucia, he had ranked amongst the top students on the island in academic ability, earning him a spot in the top-ranked high school. There, his love of singing was the motivation behind forming a school choir. He graduated with an award called the Spirit of St. Mary, for students excelling in academics but also extracurriculars. But Botham wasn't just a sharp-minded youth. He was also exceptionally kind-hearted. Following the principles of his Christian faith, he was the type of person who was always seeking out ways to help those in need. While in St. Lucia, he befriended an elderly blind man that needed some company, so Botham made regular visits and sang to the man. After graduating high school, Bo worked for a couple of years before pursuing his dream. He was very keen to attend university and to study accounting, which brought him to Harding University in Arkansas. Harding is a Christian university which suited him well, and he thrived there. As one of his best friends would say of him years later, everyone knew Botham. He immediately made everyone feel welcome. He just stood out. After moving to the US, he formed a central role in organizing a community assistance group that went out in the neighborhood and helped out people in whatever way they needed it. They cleaned up people's yards, they helped them move, they engaged positively with their community. And while he helped people, he connected with them, often spreading his joy through singing. After graduation, he started his career in Dallas, and so on the 6th of September, Bo relaxed for the night at home in the Southside Flats apartment complex. He texted friends some silly memes of good times spent together, and he had a bowl of ice cream. Then, sometime just after 10 p.m. that evening, his apartment door opened. Moments later, he was struck in the chest by a 9mm bullet. Botham John would die from that shot. The Dallas Police Department had the good sense to stay away from an investigation that involved their own, and so the case was handed over to the Texas Rangers. These investigators sat down with Amber Geiger the day following, which was the 7th of September, 2018.
Did you visually see that the door wasn't latched?
I honestly just put it in. I didn't even, usually, I'm like, oh, it's slightly ajar. You can tell it's open a little bit, it's slightly ajar.
And so that's when I push in the key more, like, to the door opens a little bit, and I'm like, someone's in here. I hear okay. moving around. And so I automatically draw my weapon.
Did you hear anything at that point?
That's when I hear moving around.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, this guy, someone's going through my stuff, or I don't know what he's doing. And so I was fear. I was scared. I thought I was going to die. I don't know what else he
And then the apartment goes this way.
Okay. So I'm literally like this, like still on the metal portion part.
Okay.
And I'm holding the door, going through the door frame. I'm holding the door open,
mm-hmm.
and I see a I see the shadow way back there. Okay. And that's when I draw. And I'm not trying to point at you.
No, you're fine, but don't you need to.
So I draw. I said, let me see your hands, let me see your hands. He was way back there. He ended up towards the more portion, the arms of the couch, closest to the kitchen. And I shoot two times. I'm thinking because he's moving around so much, he's not listening. People, when they say, let me see your hands, they're going to stop what they're doing. They're not going to continue moving.
So, in your experience, has that been the case usually?
Like
outside of this, when you've commanded somebody to...
Yeah, they usually comply. Or if they take off running, go run after them.
One topic returned to throughout this initial interview is Amber's schedule and sleeping patterns. She worked 6 days a week, Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. as a police officer, then another 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. shift every Saturday at a Baptist church. She said most of her days started at about 5:30 a.m., include overtime hours in her regular shift, a trip to the gym, and sleep by about midnight. She claimed to have gotten 5 hours of sleep the night before the shooting, and very little since. 2 days following the interview, an arrest warrant was issued for a charge of second-degree manslaughter. Amber was placed on paid leave from the police force, which remained in place for 18 days after the shooting. But protests and demonstrations outside of police headquarters and City Hall, calling out what was perceived as preferential treatment of the police, applied pressure on Dallas PD. Amber was fired from her job. And later that same month, a grand jury returned an indictment for the more serious charge of murder. In Texas, there is no first-degree designation, but a murder conviction requires the condition of malice, which meant that the state had determined that they could prove that Amber had not just acted recklessly that night, but that she acted with an intent to kill. When the trial commenced, the prosecution began by laying the foundation of this intent. There were two shots fired towards Beau from the police officer's pistol. It was what law enforcement referred to as a double tap, which is two shots in rapid succession as opposed to one. The intention of firing in this way is to increase the likelihood of hitting and of fatally wounding the target or individual. The fatal bullet struck both of them through the heart. The second missed him. It had an upward trajectory and was found lodged in the wall of the apartment. State prosecutors suggested that this was intended as a headshot, one that missed because both of them was likely in motion, perhaps still in the midst of standing from his seat on the couch.
This path is very revealing because it is consistent with the fact that Beau was getting up from his seated position and facing the door as Amber Geiger was coming into his home. The only other reasonable position that would explain that kind of a path is equally as innocuous for Beau. It would place him in a cowering position, hiding behind a 3-foot wall, a few feet in front of him that separated him from the shooter.
Conversely, Amber's defense called the incident a tragic accident. These were innocent circumstances that came together in all the wrong ways. They argued that justice could not be served by rushing to judgment as the prosecution had done.
Amber Geiger firmly and reasonably believed that she was in her own apartment. Amber Geiger firmly and reasonably believed that she had confronted an intruder in her apartment. Amber Geiger firmly and reasonably believed that she had no choice, that she had no options but to use her gun to keep from dying.
A central question being asked was whether it was reasonable for Amber to have believed that she was entering her own apartment. In Texas in 2019, they had what was called the Castle Doctrine, which was a hotly debated law. Basically, the law allows for a homeowner to protect themselves from intruders. In the language, there is an exception made for what is called a mistake of fact, meaning a mistake made in a particular situation could be accepted as fact if the mistake was reasonable. In this instance, that meant that if it was proven that Amber had reason to believe that she was in her own home, she would be allowed, under the law, to act as she did. Of course, accepting this would completely pervert the actual purpose of law and allow for the intruder to be justified in shooting the homeowner. Was it reasonable that Amber believed she was entering her own home? From the parking garage after she left her truck, Amber needed to walk across a skyway that linked the lot to her building. It's an open-air garage that allows for a 180-degree visual of the roofline of the apartment complex. Prosecutors suggested that the difference in elevation from the fourth floor where she was to the third floor where she actually lived would have been quite noticeable, particularly on a walk that she made to and from her truck on a daily basis. There are two hallways that she needed to walk down to reach her unit. It would take a young and fit person such as Amber carrying all of her gear an estimated 1.5 to 2 minutes to walk these two longer hallways. During this walk, she would pass 16 apartment doors, each of which has a lit unit number next to the door. All of these would have started with a 4 for the fourth floor. If she wasn't looking up and so missed all of her surroundings, it's argued that she could have noticed the floor mat differences along the hallway, as well as other decorative elements, such as a distinct and very large urn that is usually placed outside of one of her neighbor's doors, which would have been absent on the fourth floor. She didn't notice.
Botham Jean wanted his apartment to be very noticeable, and he took steps to make sure that happened. In front of Botham's apartment is this extremely obvious bright red floor mat right in front of his door. I want to reiterate, Amber Geiger had no floor mat. She walked right up and stepped on top of this.
Of the 349 residents of the Southside flat apartments in September 2018, 297 were polled by the defense to see how common it was to get a bit confused navigating the standardized design of the hallway with the identical looking units. 71 of those spoken to who lived on either the third or fourth floors admitted to having walked into the wrong apartment by accident at some point. That is nearly a quarter of all residents that lived on the floors with Amber and Botham. But when the state prosecutors asked if any of these residents had entered the wrong apartment and then shot at the people they found inside, they said, "No, we did not do that." It was also accepted that there were wider spread issues with the key fobs inside the building. Amber reported previous issues with her electronic access not working and was led to believe from building management that this was not uncommon. Neighbors confirmed that many of the locks were slightly misaligned and defective and would not always latch properly. They reported needing to jiggle latches one way or another, and sometimes the locks would not respond consistently to the fobs. All of this seemed to suggest that Amber's ease of access into Botham's apartment with her key and a door slightly ajar would not have seemed odd to her. Protesters, the media, and public observers of the case at the time all questioned how a trained police officer could miss so many signs that night. Her team says this was likely due to exhaustion. After overtime hours, days on end, and another 13-hour shift, Amber was moving on autopilot. Prosecutors suggested a slightly different theory. Phone records showed Amber on the phone with a colleague of hers that night, Martin Rivera, her patrol partner with whom she was also romantically involved. Their texts indicated that the two may have been planning to get together that night, so how tired could Amber have been? The two were exchanging racy text messages right up to the moment that she reached the apartment door. Two more texts were sent from Amber to Martin a few minutes past 10 p.m. while Botham lay on the ground struggling to breathe.
Should you be giving 100% of your attention to the person who's dying in front of you if you can?
Yes, you should.
Should you be sending text messages?
No.
Both of them erased the text from their phones, but investigators were nonetheless able to retrieve them. Martin Rivera was married at the time and said these were not conversations that either of them wanted to remember. In addition to the details of the affair casting Amber in a very unpleasant light, the jury was shown postings of hers on social media that further diminished her character. A conflicting story to Amber's was offered by one neighbor, Joshua Brown, who had returned home to his apartment within moments of Amber entering Botham's home. From down the hallway, Joshua testified that he heard the two encounter each other as if by surprise, and then immediately he heard gunshots. Most notably, Joshua did not hear Amber yell at Botham to raise his hands or offer any other type of warning.
Do you recall ever hearing someone say, "Hey, put your hands up," in a loud tone?
No, ma'am.
Although Joshua had met Botham only once, he broke down in tears in court when he began to testify. Joshua said he heard Bo singing gospel music from across the hall every morning. 10 days after testifying, Joshua was shot to death himself in the parking lot of the apartment complex where he lived. This was not the Southside Flats. Joshua had reportedly moved about 3 months after Botham died. The timing of his murder fueled rumors that his role in the trial had made him a target, with some alleging a conspiracy by local law enforcement. Police obviously denied all accusations and further pointed out that if a witness was going to be killed to prevent their testimony, it would usually occur before, not after they had given it. In December, 3 men that Joshua knew personally were indicted for his murder. They may have been attempting to rob him. Prosecutors argued that Amber had made the decision to shoot to kill the apparent intruder inside the apartment the moment that she heard shuffling noises and acknowledged that there was someone inside. This was before she had even opened the door. When Amber took the stand at her trial, she insisted that she had in fact called out to Botham to raise his hands more than once and loudly before she fired her weapon, in direct contradiction to Joshua's earlier testimony.
Why even heard you say that?
I can't tell you why.
Well, it's because you didn't say it.
Amber was grilled further by the prosecution over her inconsistent application of her police training. She displayed multiple examples of her training leading up to the encounter, from the way she parked her truck, how she left her firing hand free, and the double tap technique that was used. But after this, Amber's police radio was working but not used, and after her tragic mistake, her first aid kit remained untouched amongst her gear.
Is there a reason why you didn't use this stuff right here, which is designed to control traumatic bleeding?
It never crossed my mind.
It didn't even cross your mind?
No, sir.
Even though he's bleeding in front of you?
No.
And this is inches from you?
It did not cross my mind.
It never crossed your mind to use this?
No, sir.
This is a first aid kit that's also included in there, right?
Yes, sir.
And you've got more of that exact same stuff in here. 10.03 p.m. and at 10.02 p.m., you sent text messages to Mark Rivera.
Yes, I did.
Text messages that would have required you to have put the phone in a place where you can see it, and you used your fingers to write out the words, "I need you, hurry, dot, dot, dot," right?
I don't remember how many hands I used.
But you texted Mr. Rivera using your hands.
Yes, I did.
And as you were doing that, you were unable to give Mr. Jean your full attention, the attention that he deserved.
Yes, I did.
And then you made the choice to do that a second time. Isn't that true? Here.
Yes, sir.
All right, so from here to where you were at the door, that's when you decided to shoot twice.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's called a double tap, right?
Yes, sir.
Is that what you were intending?
Yes, sir.
That's your training, isn't it?
It's what we're trained to do.
It's training. Double tap maximizes the lethality of your shooting, doesn't it?
Yes, sir. Just did what I was trained to do.
Because you resort to training, right?
Yes, I do.
You rely on your training?
Yes, sir.
It aids you?
Yes, sir.
And in crisis, you resort to your training?
Yes, sir.
When you shot at Mr. Jean, you knew you were using deadly force against him.
Yes.
You know what a bullet can do, don't you?
Yes, I do.
And when you shot at him twice, you intended to kill him.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Closing arguments were watched intently nationwide, while continued protests and demonstrations fed the media frenzy and speculation for the outcome. At one point, the DA gave an interview to the news media, a blatant violation of instructions given by the judge, and she was not impressed.
I'd like the DA to get an interview about this trial. On Fox 4 News, Your Honor, yes. And I have a video and the article from Fox 4 and the screenshot from the data disk. It was short, but...
The jury deliberated for about 5 hours. They dismissed both the lesser charge of manslaughter and Amber's contention that she had acted in self-defense. She was found guilty of murder with malice, as she had admitted on the stand that she had shot to kill. Two jurors who spoke about the decision-making process after the trial told the press that they struggled far more with the sentencing deliberations than agreeing on the conviction. Within 5 minutes of being in the room, they said, they had voted to convict Amber of murder. They said her affair, text messages, and social media posts had little to no influence on the decision. They believed what the prosecution had asserted, that she had decided to fire her weapon with the intent to kill before she was fully through the door. The prosecution requested that the jury consider a sentence of 28 years for the conviction. When those closest to Botham took the stand during the sentencing phase of the trial, it was only days after what would have been his 28th birthday.
I always referred to him as the glue to my three kids, because he was able to relate to Alyssa and bring Alyssa to Brand and vice versa. But Botham was also, he also was this take charge type of person. So he was always giving advice, both to Alyssa and to Brand. He was, although he was the younger brother, but he treated her like he was the older brother. And it was more so because he was bigger and taller than her. So he assumed the role of big brother, although she was 10 years older than him.
Now, when you and both of them became friends, had you were already dating your husband?
I actually was not dating my husband yet. My husband and I began dating about 6 months after both of them and I had met.
And how did that relationship go when you tell your husband, my guy, my person, is a male friend?
Well, Botham and I like to always say that we were the exception to the rule that boys and girls can't be friends. And I told my husband, I said, hey, I love you, but this man is going to be in my life forever. And he's going to be a part of us forever because, thank you. We debated on what success meant to us, you know, whether it was how much money you had or what your job title was, but he just really believed that success was your impact on people and how you help people.
Jurors felt that the state was asking them to apply an eye for an eye with a 28-year sentence, but based on what they understood of the man that Botham was, they did not think this is what he would have wanted. They said if Botham had been shot and survived, they believed that he would have forgiven Amber Geiger. Despite the power to give up to 99 years in prison and the recommendation of 28, the jurors agreed to give Amber Geiger 10 years, which included some time served.
If I forgive you, and I know if you go to God and ask him, he will forgive you.
After the jurors had left the courtroom, Botham's brother stepped down from the witness stand and embraced his brother's killer in an act of forgiveness. The jury said seeing this later validated the decision they had made. That is the heartbreaking story of Botham John and the conviction of Amber Geiger. Thank you so much for joining me here today. My name is Kevin. This is Just Thought Lounge, and I'll see you in the next one.